And I know, you're probably saying, okay, I'm confused. What is that music? Aha!
Is that Peter pulling country out?
No.
Which
no,
country?
No, it's interesting, and the individual who is playing that happens to be in studio with us this morning. It's our pleasure to welcome in Professor Ann Rasmussen. You didn't know that I was going to open with that, did you?
I didn't. I was surprised, and I even recognized myself playing. So that's,
really?
That's pretty exciting. It's amazing what you can find on YouTube.
Well, yeah, boy, there's the truth. What is the instrument you're playing?
It's called an oud. So that is spelled in a variety of ways, O-U-D.
O-U-D.
Or sometimes with the Arabic letter ein, and then wow, dal, so like a backwards apostrophe, U-D.
It looks like a bazooka.
Well, it is related to pretty much all of the plucked lutes of the Mediterranean,
okay.
And it is the grandmother of our guitar and mandolin and everything, because the Arabs brought that kind of instrument into Andalusia, Spain, and Portugal during the great Arab Empire of the 7th to 14th century, before they got kicked out with the Spanish Inquisition. And so many of the instruments of the kind of Western
right.
instrumentarium derive from earlier models from the Middle East region and Middle East, Central Asia, Silk Road.
Okay, we could see. I was a history major in college, so we could do this all morning. I love
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yes, I know.
This is great.
This is great.
But you are your particular area, and I'm not going to insult you by pretending I know anything about it. I'm not even going to go there.
Okay.
Ethnomusicology.
Mm-hmm.
What is ethnomusicology?
Okay, ethnomusicology is the anthropological study of music of the world's peoples.
Oh.
So when we walk into a college and walk into a college music department and take history of music, the subtext is history of Western European art music. We
right.
don't ask history of what music?
Right.
History of the music of New Hampshire? No. Yeah. History of the music of the United States? Whose music in the United States, right? So ethnomusicology levels the playing field. It really is the study of all people's music. So it can be of that could be a very small community, you
sure.
know, right here in the White Mountains. It could be the music of a particular country, like Oman in the Arab Gulf,
right.
that I'm going to talk about this evening. And ethnomusicology is also very interdisciplinary. So rather than looking at musical pieces like this great symphony or this this great quartet, we really look at music and culture, or we really look at culture and society through the lens of music. So what does a culture do with their music? What can we learn about religion? What can we learn about gender? What can we learn about politics through music? We're not interested in saying, this is the best music, and this music is a little bit
right.
less good, and
right,
this
right,
music,
right, yeah, right.
This
yeah,
music
it's not
is really
that at all.
Uninteresting. It's rather, if this music is really important to people, important enough, say, to be censored,
mm-hmm.
right? Or important enough to
sure.
elevate people to spiritual states
mm-hmm.
or to activate some kind of ritual or to be the hippest, you know, popular music that everybody is listening to, then why is that so? So that's what ethnomusicologists do. And in a kind of more basic way, we teach about the world through music. So
mm-hmm.
in my courses, we're looking at music in Africa and India and music of different minority groups.
Is there a common
thread
between all of these?
Yes, I think that you know every society has music, but its meanings are not universal. So it's
mm-hmm.
really people that assign meaning to music.
Now, say when you were in the studio while Pat was just. Before Pat did news, you were tuning up your
oud. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. I'm still on the bazooka. I'm sorry. Because it's a beautiful instrument. Whatever you were playing, for some reason, I was immediately thinking of somebody playing a banjo in Appalachia. I could hear the similarities in the tonality. And I went, wow. So here we are talking about Oman, and I'm thinking the Appalachians, and I'm thinking maybe there is some sort of symbiotic relationship there.
Well, you know, I think we all, we're all comparative in the way we learn.
Yeah,
whatever,
it's true.
If you encounter a new thing, you compare it to something that you already know.
Correct.
So you probably are recognizing, okay, this is a plucked lute. It's
right.
Solo.
Right, right.
I was playing something that might have kind of a mournful sound, yeah. In Appalachia. We might call that high lonesome sound.
Yep.
You could make a very long and loose connection between the Arab world and Appalachia.
Right,
through Africa.
Broad. Right, right.
But you'd really be kind of going out on a limb a little bit.
Could I get tenure out of this?
No.
Okay. Nice try anyway.
If you were my dissertation student, I'd probably say, let's focus that a little bit.
So the reality is, even though music is universal, it's not universal in where it has come from and what it means to a specific place, which, as you pointed out at the beginning, there is so much more in the music of a place, the politics, the religion, mm-hmm. The culture, that really comes out in that particular music.
Yeah, and that's what I'm going to talk about this evening with my my research in Oman.
Now, where are you speaking tonight?
I'm speaking at the University of New Hampshire. I'm speaking for the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire.
Great organization.
And it's a real honor and privilege to do this. I do lots of speaking in classes to my students and at conferences to my colleagues, and to be able to get out in the public forum and make what I do relevant and interesting is just terrific. And the World Affairs Council also has me working hard today. I'll be up at Dartmouth. Visiting colleague Ted Levin, who's also an ethnomusicologist, world-renowned ethnomusicologist up there. And then I'll be doing a workshop at a high school and a workshop at a middle school.
Wow.
So, wow.
Now,
let me
draw a distinction. When you're at UNH tonight, that's UNH Manchester, right, Carly?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Not UNH
Good call.
Durham.
Good call. Thank you.
So if you are curious, Manchester as opposed to driving out to Durham tonight. So
correct.
I wanted to draw that distinction. Can you play a piece of music that would infuriate somebody in the Gulf?
Ooh, good question.
Well, to us, it's music.
Yeah.
But as she's saying, what it means and how you interpret it is different. So
yeah. So for example, I could let's flip that around. I could probably play some music for you that you would go, ugh. Ick, or it's too, you don't like the vocal timbre, or it sounds sounds like cacophony, but I could help if I know something about that music and know about that music on its own terms, as one of my colleagues says. I could help you listen to that music. What's important?
I was going to say that's
What's
wonderful.
The
that's wonderful
part about that music.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if someone from Mars walks into a baseball game and listens to the national anthem, and everybody's up on their feet cheering and hollering. Why?
Yeah.
So what, right? So
it's
why
an okay
is that
song.
Music...
Why are these people all excited about this one song?
Yeah. Right. I mean, if we just think about that, if we think about the national anthem and we think about the various controversies about the national anthem, particularly recently, that we have this idea, people should behave in this certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just a song. For
it's
God's
just
sakes,
I know.
And the words don't really mean anything to anybody today. Right. You can go and study those words and understand the context where they came from.
Absolutely.
But when we sing that song, we're not really thinking about that in literal terms in the way we might think of if Adele sings a love song, it's like that means something to us. We understand
love,
those
I get
lyrics.
Love.
Right.
Yes, I know. I've never seen Ramparts. I know.
Well, music means different things to different people at different points of their life.
Yeah.
So you can play a love song. And at 17, you're going, what are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden at 43, oh, my God, that's my life.
Yeah. The first time a young woman broke up with him, he was devastated.
Ugh.
And I said, well, now you understand song lyrics so much better.
Yeah.
Because you have to have your own heartbreak to understand that heartache.
Yep.
So.
Does music from Oman, I mean, we're used to... God, I apologize, but like the Rolling Stones singing, She Broke My Heart, or the Beatles did this, or Adele did this. Do they still have that in Oman? Do they still cover topics like She Broke My Heart or, you know.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, there are certain universal themes, and love is definitely, love and departure and feeling alone and feeling betrayed, longing and these kinds of themes. And, you know, in Arabic, which is the language of Omani music, poetry is such a big deal. It goes back, you know, before the time of Islam. There is poetry is an extraordinary part of literature, and even now, I would say in contemporary Arab society, poetry is a much more prominent kind of discursive realm, if you will, where you know, people know about poets. Amateurs make poetry at weddings, or if you go to a, you know, if you go to an event, there will be somebody improvising verses and so forth. So, and often with those universal themes, you find, you know, all kinds of metaphors and analogy, metaphors to nature and beauty.
Of course,
and,
of course.
You know, her cheeks are like flowers, or his eyes are like, you know, whatever. Right. So those things are certainly universal. With mass media and, you know, kind of transnational media scapes, we certainly have the Rolling Stones, you know, all over the world.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Some of the surprising things to me in my research in Oman, which I'll talk about tonight, is really kind of the political economy of the music business, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Oman is an extraordinarily beautiful nation. You know, 2,000 miles of beach, amazing mountains. This January, I'll be leading a student group with my colleague who's a geologist. So we've got a nature
great.
Culture study abroad. Talk about interdisciplinarity, right?
Wow.
So it's called the Contemporary Culture and Natural History of Oman, but we've also dubbed it Rock Music Oman.
There we go.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Could we audit that class?
Let's
go with that.
You can come along.
That'd be great.
But anyway, I mean, the geology of the country is spectacular, and the culture is fascinating. Most Gulf nations think of Oman as a Ruh al-Khalij, which means the soul of the Gulf. It's kind of seen to be more authentic for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One, it doesn't have quite the urban density of places like Abu Dhabi and Dubai and in Qatar and so forth. Secondly, the natural beauty is extraordinary. Thirdly, there are more Omanis living in Oman than there are native nationals living in other countries in the Gulf.
Wow.
So let me translate that.
Wow.
As we know, the Gulf is incredibly dependent on foreign labor.
Third country nationals.
Yep.
So those beautiful buildings and those incredible highways and those dams and so forth are built by South Asians.
Right.
And the car dealerships and hotels are run by Syrians. And
the staff.
And the Iraqis.
The nannies.
And the nannies are Indonesians.
Yep.
And the restaurant to help, who's going to wait on you, are probably from the Philippines.
Right.
So a huge number of non-nationals, transnationals, migrant labor, particularly in the, you know, in building the, you know, in the oil industry and so forth.
Sure.
But so where Oman has like 54% Omanis, somewhere like Qatar has in 12, 13, 14, 15, 16% people who are from Qatar, and the rest of the population comes from elsewhere.
Right.
So there are more natives to do the authentic native work of the country. And when you think about culture, that's kind of what people expect. They expect that natives will be producing that.
Of course, you're going to come into the culture, right?
Right.
I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
Now, if you take Omani music, is it understood? Does it translate well in Qatar, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, the rest of the region, or is it peculiar and only Omanis would get it?
That's an excellent question. The Gulf until recently was kind of one big region.
Right.
And then it was carved up into different you know, different kind of nations. And if we look at Oman, they've really only been a nation since 1970.
Wow.
When Sultan Qaboos, who is the current ruler, took over from his father and completely modernized the place from, you know, in 1970s, people will tell me, we had 10 miles of paved road.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Girls didn't really go to school. We had one hospital, and now it's a very modern nation. And their kind of culture is tied to environment. So all around the Gulf, you have cultures that are associated with seafaring and with trade.
Sure.
Particularly in Oman, they have been the shipbuilders and the navigators of the world since the 9th century.
Oh, that's great.
And so there's a whole kind of cultural, you know, industry, music and crafts and knowledge systems and so forth that are associated with seafaring. Then, of course, you have the Bedouin of the desert.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We have people like Wilfred Thesiger, you know, who's sort of the Lawrence of Arabia of Oman, a British explorer who went across the empty quarter to document this just incredible, you know, incredible culture. How do people actually live in the desert in this hostile environment? And so there is culture and, you know, and stories and music and dancing that's associated with the desert. And then there's kind of a settled, you know, settled communities, people who hang out by oases.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what do you do in an oasis? Well, in an oasis, you can actually build a house and stay there. You can cultivate crops. You can.
Right.
And so there are kinds of music and performance culture associated with that environment. So in that way, all those states around the Gulf, whether it's Qatar or Kuwait or United Arab Emirates, would recognize those three kinds, those three styles of music.
And interesting.
I think, you know, throughout the Gulf, people have been very proactively engaged in like national festivals and kind of folklorizing their, you know, their native musics. So it's definitely music in the public ear, but it's some pretty funky stuff. I mean, it is some very folky, you know, whereas Syria or Lebanon or Egypt have a very kind of high culture music that was patronized by sultans and political leaders and has a really sophisticated music theory attached to it. Oman and the Gulf, it's really the wild
villages
in some ways.
A much simpler lifestyle.
Much simpler lifestyle. No kind of court music.
Right, right.
So
that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
Court music.
Yeah.
I referenced the fact I had been in Kuwait, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And the Kuwaitis, the emir was telling everybody, I think it was for a month or two, everybody had to leave their job. And they had to go to the desert in Kuwait.
Wow.
And but it sounds better than what it is. They had these elaborate tents with satellite dishes, air conditioners. They would pave. Okay. So you weren't going out roughing it. But the whole purpose was, okay, we got oil. We got a lot of money. We're bringing in people from around the world to be your nannies, to run the shops. Mm-hmm. I want you to remember where you came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was the object of sending him back to the... And so I saw this, but I'm seeing Mercedes parked on the pavement to the tent, which was five tents strung together. I mean, phenomenal place. But they had to live in the desert for... It was a month.
And you mentioned the satellite dishes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And air conditioning units and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But the purpose was, remember who we are. Mm-hmm, remember where we came from. Mm-hmm. Do not forget that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, okay, irrespective of the money that was being lavished on my temporary camping trip, the fact that it was important enough to do not lose our identity, I thought that was an important point.
It is an important point. It's interesting to see the way that is managed top down, right? It would be, you know, as if we would say in New Hampshire, okay, everybody has to go out in a cabin in the woods and cross-country ski. You know, because that's what we did in New England.
let's do that, and
not just have a kitschy thing at a rest stop that where you can buy a skier as a refrigerator magnet. But let's make so. And wouldn't it be wonderful, actually?
That would be great.
I'd be thrilled. But yeah, so to see the way the nation state actually manages the people, so that there's a cultural there, and I think there's a bit of anxiety about that simply because there are very few natives and those natives, you know, native-born people, and the wealth has been extraordinary. I mean, they've had, you know, 300 years of modernization in whatever, 30 or, you know, whatever the metrics are. So my work this evening, I'm going to be talking a little bit about kind of the cultural politics of the recording industry, really, and who actually does the music of Oman. And it's not always Omanis that are doing this.
So there's put a different ear to it.
So that, you know, kind of the economy of the music business is revealing of other kinds of political and economic trends that, say, political scientists or economists might be interested in.
Right.
And here it is trickling down into the music industry. Why should we be surprised? I think partially because when we think about a culture's music, we think that, you know, we're going to go to culture X and we're going to see people X doing music X, and it's going to be this authentic experience. Mm-hmm. And it's just as kind of transnational and globalized as other economies.
You know, Anne, if you had a little more passion for the subject, this would have been a better conversation. Give us something to work on before you come back.
Right, come on, it's early in the morning. Don't give me such a hard time.
And we've warmed you up for Dartmouth now. You're ready to go.
Okay.
But let me ask you one question. Is there a popular misconception or a stereotype that people in New Hampshire have of Gulf people that you're sitting here going, boy, if I could correct one thing, what would that be?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure what New Hampshire thinks about Gulf people, but certainly people who dress differently from us always seem exotic to us.
True.
One thing that's interesting about that men often wear long, it's called a dishdasha, a long, usually white, long-sleeved robe. And, you know, when you spend some time in the desert, you really understand why people wear long, flowy clothes. It's really important. It's sandy, it's windy, and it's incredibly sunny. And, you know, I mean, we wouldn't survive for a minute without long, flowy clothes and, you know, headdresses.
Right.
So the turban is very much part of the men's dress, and these, you know, kind of long dresses, if you will. And I remember when I think it was President Bush.
Hey, I have
Bush
kilts.
Went over there.
I got a kilt. So,
yeah,
you know.
And people were laughing because, you know, he was holding hands with somebody. And, oh.
I know.
You know, people have different ways of being social. And just because, you know, men happen to hold hands. I mean, we have, you know, football players that love to pile up on each other every, you know, 30 seconds in a game. I mean, and so men like to touch each other in different ways, in different I was going to say in different places, but I'll say in different cultures. So that, and then also women who are often in black.
Right.
This is really more fashion and nationalism than it is an expression of religious piety.
Ooh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
In other now, I do a lot of work in Indonesia, and their, you know, full headscarf and so forth is usually almost always a marker of religious piety. Or just like, I come from this kind of a family and I want you to take me seriously.
Right.
And so
sure.
I'm wearing these modest clothes as opposed to these other kinds of less modest clothes, particularly for women. But in the Gulf, the dress is really more a sign of sovereignty and kind of national loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when you see all these other workers from different countries, you know, the men are wearing pants and the women are wearing whatever. But then you see, you know, people, women in, you know, in black and with headdresses. And once you get out of the public eye, you've got, you know, regular street clothes underneath. You visit people in their homes or whatever, and, you know, off comes the outer layers and so forth.
Right.
So I think the clothing thing usually lets people just lets their imaginations run wild, and that's all connected to Orientalism and Islamophobia
I was asking.
Yeah.
Carly's getting antsy because you got to get up 89 and get to Dartmouth. My God, we could talk for hours. This is phenomenal.
This is great.
I'd love to get you back, maybe on the phone sometime, or if you're back in New Hampshire, come up, visit Dad. Swing by the studio. It's always open.
Thank you.
And the door is always open. You are phenomenal, and I hope you pack them tonight and open some people's eyes and ears.
Well, I have spectacular slides and videos, and it's an extraordinarily beautiful place, and I've got some exciting music to play. So I hope you come this evening at the University of New Hampshire.
At Manchester. From 6 to 7:15.
6 to 7:15, yep.
Sponsored by the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. Thank you so much
for
inviting me.
WACNH.org.
Yep.
Oh, you're good.
Man.
You're good.
There you go. All right. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Back with more after this.
Kale and Company. This afternoon from noon to 3. Live on Facebook and live on your station for news, talk, and sports. 1077. The Pulse.